ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 22nd of April. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Hundreds of people attended a candlelight vigil to honour the victims of last Saturday's mass murder at Bondi Junction in Sydney's east. Survivors, families of the victims and emergency personnel were there as political leaders acknowledged the grief that's been felt nationwide. Some women who attended say while the attack shattered their sense of public safety, the community's response has given them strength. Gavin Coote reports.
As darkness fell over Bondi Beach last night, hundreds of people lit candles in memory of those killed in last weekend's Westfield shopping centre massacre. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese offered the nation's condolences to the many family and friends of the victims that had come to the candlelight vigil.
We gather here in Bondi to grieve for all that has been stolen from us. All the possibility and potential, all the kindness and humanity, all the love and laughter of the six lives snatched away on that hardest of Saturday afternoons.
The New South Wales Premier Chris Minns spoke of the sense of easy peace that was shattered when the murderous attack took place at Bondi Junction, but also of the depth of community support and grief for the victims' families.
This week we saw a single bouquet left on Oxford Street grow into a sea of flowers. And here tonight we have a sea of people mourning your loss.
Despite the shock that's rippled through this eastern suburbs community, Bondi Junction locals like Tamara Leckie-Thompson reckon the vigil has shown they won't give in to fear.
I mean, it just reminds me why I live here, really. Having everyone get together just shows that everyone's there for each other and we will move on.
Police are investigating whether the attacker, Joel Couchy, was specifically targeting women, with five of the six victims being female. Many in the vigil crowd were young women, including housemates Tia and Malia, who travelled from Redfern in the city's inner south to pay their respects.
Having everyone show up tonight has made me feel safer. Such a weird experience living in Sydney. I don't think we've ever had to worry about anything like this.
But tonight has made you feel that little bit safer, or at least helped counteract that a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. There's good people.
It's a good reminder that there's good people. I feel like you don't see it on the news much, but it's nice to have a moment in such immense pain and tragedy and horror to like see there's actually some real amazing people that go above.
And it's not just Bondi, it's Sydney.
Some friends of the victims are already taking steps to ensure their legacies live on. A blood drive has been launched in honour of Faraz Tahir, the 30-year-old security guard who was killed while trying to stop the attacker. Adnan Kader is the president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Youth Association.
Faraz have fled the persecution from his home country in Pakistan, have moved to Australia. This was his first day job on that particular location, and this untragic event falls up.
There was some hopeful news as the vigil got underway. The nine-month-old baby whose mother was killed in the attack was discharged from hospital and is now home with her family.
Gavin Coote reporting there. There appears to be political agreement in cracking down on misinformation and graphic content published on social media following the Sydney stabbings last week. Elon Musk, the owner of X, previously known as Twitter, has mocked demands by Australia's Eve Safety Commission to remove graphic material that was shared on the platform. The federal opposition says it'll back government moves to further regulate the industry. Monty Bovell reports.
The shocking stabbings in Sydney have filled our social media feeds with graphic and confronting posts. Misinformation on the events spread quickly. Belinda Barnett is a senior lecturer in media and communications at Swinburne University.
If nothing changes, we can expect that this is the new normal after a major news event.
The federal government is renewing its focus on social media misinformation and harm in the wake of the stabbing attacks. Social media platform X, formerly Twitter, is fighting government demands it take down violent and offensive posts about the stabbings.
X seems to have done zero. In theory, it should be really quick and easy for them now. The technology exists to detect it with AI. There's really no reason why those videos should still be on X.
X's billionaire owner Elon Musk says the takedown order on the footage was a demand for global content bans by Australia's censorship commissar. The government's made it clear it doesn't care what Elon Musk thinks. Here's Cabinet Minister Chris Bowen.
Elon Musk might be happy for Twitter to be a cesspit of misinformation and violence. We're not, and we won't put up with it.
And there's growing bipartisan political frustration with the social media giants. The Shadow Minister for Communications is David Coleman.
We just can't trust social media companies. They do not act in the best interests of Australians, and frankly, they don't care a great deal about the best interests of Australians.
It's a frustration that could provide a new opportunity to push forward stalled misinformation laws. The federal government proposed strengthening the Australian Communications and Media Authority's powers to be able to look under the hood of platforms to see that they were complying with industry standards, with the ability to impose fines on companies who repeatedly breached those standards. But that legislation was delayed, with a promise to rework it after concerns it would cause companies to over-censor to avoid penalties. The coalition also had concerns, but they've now flagged they're open to the proposed laws, as long as they don't restrict free speech.
We don't want a bill that does impinge on your ability to express a view in a democracy, because that's really fundamental.
There's an acceptance that government intervention would help, but won't solve all the issues. And experts such as Belinda Barnett say it's also up to individual social media users to play a role.
We need people who are going to social media after a news event to immediately check the source of anything that they see trending on social media.
Swinburne University Media and Communications lecturer Belinda Barnett ending that report from Monty Bovill. Ukraine's presidents welcome the approval of a nearly $100 billion US dollar aid package, which he says will give his country the chance to go on the offensive in its war against Russia. Moscow's responded by calling it a road to escalation. Republican House of Representatives Speaker Mike Johnson was crucial in getting the package passed and might lose his job as a result. With more, here's North America correspondent Carrington Clark.
For months, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has been lobbying hard for more American support, warning that his country was being outgunned by Russia and was struggling to hold onto territory. He told NBC's Meet the Press that this support could not come soon enough.
Now we have all the chance to stabilize the situation and to overtake the initiative. And that's why we need to actually have the weapon systems. When we get it, when we have it in our arms, then we do have the chance to take this initiative and to move ahead and to protect Ukraine.
The nearly $100 billion package includes funds to replenish Ukraine's nearly empty ammunition stockpiles, as well as humanitarian assistance. It was passed in the House of Representatives with bipartisan support from both Republicans and Democrats, though notably some hard-right Republicans voted against it. The Democratic chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner, told CBS that he's confident it'll quickly be approved by his chamber. He says the longer-range missiles, ATACMS, that Ukraine has long sought will be in their hands fast.
I hope once this gets to the president by Tuesday or Wednesday, that these shipments will be literally launched with that longer range attack.
By next week.
I hope once the president signs, we've been told that it is the president's signature, making sure Congress does its job, that these materials will be in transit by the end of the week.
But it could be a difficult week for Republican Speaker Mike Johnson. He may have succeeded in getting the aid deal approved, but his job is now on the line, with multiple members of his party threatening to roll him over it. Democrat Congressman Ro Khanna said he would vote to keep his political opponent in his job.
And I give him credit for doing this. I would actually vote to table any motion to vacate him. You know, Chairman McCaul quoted Churchill. One of the things Churchill said is that America always exhausted every wrong option until doing the right thing. Yeah. And this shows that American democracy still is very strong.
But a Republican speaker relying on Democrats to keep their job would be an extraordinary situation in a town where polarization has become so extreme. If the speaker does lose his job, Ukraine will be concerned that this US aid package may prove to be the last of its type. This is Carrington Clark in Washington reporting for AM.
More than 100 renewable energy projects are waiting for approval under federal environmental protection laws in what's being described as the single biggest challenge for delivering clean power in Australia. Pushback from farmers and regional communities means developers are increasingly seeking out uncleared or undeveloped land for potential projects. And while that avoids conflicts with landholders, it's potentially threatening the habitats of native species. Here's National Regional Affairs reporter Jane Norman.
In far north Queensland, nature photographer and conservationist Stephen Nowakowski is still processing a decision that's been 3 years in the making.
It was a feeling of relief, but also frustration that we had to fight against a project that should never have been proposed in that location in the first place.
That project was the proposed Warroora Station Wind Farm, next to the Wet Tropics of Queensland World Heritage Area. Arc Energy had planned to clear 500 hectares of native vegetation for the project, which, because of fierce local opposition, had been drastically scaled back from 200 turbines to 42. But late on Friday, Arc Energy announced it was no longer proceeding with the project, and Stephen Nowakowski's fight was over.
It's an oxymoron to think that we can clear our forests to try to save the planet.
Before it was axed, the wind farm was being assessed under federal environmental laws because it had the potential to impact the habitats of threatened species, including koalas and the magnificent brood frog. But that process had taken 3 years, and a final decision had been delayed five times. John Corbell from the Clean Energy Investor Group says it's a problem many projects are encountering.
At the moment, timeliness and consistency of the application of federal environment law is poor.
And how long is it taking?
We see many instances where projects are taking several years to achieve an assessment decision. So these types of delays are simply unacceptable, and they're holding up the rollout of clean energy projects across the country.
A record 130 renewable energy projects are currently being assessed by the Federal Environment Department, which, according to government figures, is taking around 80 weeks or 20 months to reach a final decision. The minister responsible, Tanya Plibersek, recently committed $100 million to help speed that up. But it's a careful balancing act for the government, supporting the rapid rollout of renewables to cut emissions while ensuring the wave of new projects doesn't harm the environment in the process.
The bottom line is important habitat is not the place to put renewable energy.
Felicity Wade is from Labor's Environment Action Network.
You've really got to find land that has already been used and repurpose it for this important infrastructure.
The Australian Conservation Foundation's Kelly O'Shaughnessy says clearer guidelines are also desperately needed.
So we need really strong planning in Australia that actually says these are parts of Australia that we need to protect for nature. These are the parts of Australia where we can develop. And when it comes to renewable energy, they can actually identify renewable energy zones to make sure that we're not putting renewable energy in places that will damage nature.
Kelly O'Shaughnessy from the Australian Conservation Foundation, ending that report from Jane Norman. Doctors say the health sector's carbon dioxide emissions and waste pose a threat to public health. In Australia, hospitals, pharmaceuticals and medical devices make up about 7% of our carbon footprint. But healthcare workers are finding new ways to decarbonise hospitals, reduce medical waste and reuse medical devices. Catherine Gregory reports.
When you've been in a hospital, you would have most likely seen the huge amounts of waste generated by single-use items such as plastic gloves, needles, plastic packaging and medical equipment.
Out the other side of one operation, one knee operation, one hip operation, you will see 8, 9, 15 bags, full bags of medical waste, of plastic waste, of rubbish.
Professor Nick Watts is the director of the Centre for Sustainable Medicine at the National University of Singapore, and he describes a hidden cost, how hospitals generate huge carbon emissions.
So the carbon emissions from a healthcare system, they range from about 5 to 7% of a country's emissions in total.
So what happens? Well, for example, there are things like the anaesthetic gas called desflurane. One bottle is about the same as burning 440 kilograms of coal. Then there's the production, transportation and disposal of drugs, chemicals and medical devices. Even MRI machines and asthma inhalers contribute.
Reduce is the most effective thing you can to reuse, reprocess. That is the second most effective thing.
He says simple things like improving diagnostic skills and reducing the amount of patient testing helps cut waste and carbon, as does keeping patient or medication transportation minimal. All this requires a more digitalised system and the ability to reuse complex medical devices.
And so increasingly we are seeing medical device companies start to turn around and say, hey, do you know what? If you hand this back to us, we think we can re-sterilise it, we can reprocess it, we can get it back to you in a couple of days, be a fraction of the cost. That's going to save a lot of carbon as well.
These sorts of practices are now being implemented here in Australia, particularly in emergency departments. Brian O'Connell is an emergency doctor in Coffs Harbour and is the sustainable healthcare lead for New South Wales Health on the mid-north coast.
We're starting to measure our waste streams, our carbon footprint more accurately. So we know where these target hotspots are and how we can maximise impact and track progress.
For example, in one health district, glove use has reduced by 30%, and in some emergency departments, testing has also been cut by a third. While surgery departments are starting to minimise the use of certain anaesthetic gases or find alternatives, Brian O'Connell says cutting carbon does not mean reducing the quality of healthcare.
What we're doing is looking at the evidence and how we can, you know, do our practices better and taking a new approach that's low carbon, low waste, and it turns out to be really high quality healthcare. So the sustainable ED is going to get bigger and bigger. So yeah, it's a quite exciting space.
Coffs Harbour emergency doctor Brian O'Connell ending that report by Catherine Gregory. Some of Australia's largest businesses are sourcing products from social enterprises, for-profit businesses that are tackling social problems like long-term unemployment in diverse and vulnerable communities. And some governments are mandating that a proportion of large contracts must be spent with social enterprises, and as a consequence, the sector's increasing. Ashmita Thiruselvam reports.
In this factory, in a former supermarket in Melbourne's inner city, workers like Susie Amare are making high-vis vests for construction workers. But the clothes don't just protect people on building sites. They make a difference to her too.
This job helped me with finance. I'm not going anymore centering. Before when I start and now is very big difference.
Susie is employed by Assembled Threads. It's a social enterprise, a growing for-profit business model that tackles social problems. Edwina Walsh is the chief executive.
It's a fantastic game changer to actually embed corporate responsibility and provide social and environmental impact.
The social enterprise model often provides training and employment for people in vulnerable communities, but it's not a charity.
We are a commercial enterprise looking to build sustainable income channels through the procurement of our product. So we solely rely on income and orders.
The sector is growing. The Victorian government legislated that any government contract over $20 million must work with a social enterprise. And more governments and large corporates are mandating that a proportion of the cost of contracts be spent with social enterprises.
By buying goods and services from a social enterprise, you're getting the quality goods you need, as well as social and environmental impact in the same transaction.
That's Tara Anderson from Social Traders. She works to certify social enterprises and strengthen their business models and says they encourage companies to create greater impact in their communities.
Businesses are spending more with social enterprises too. There's been $843 million spent with them in the last 6 years. We want that to grow to $5.5 billion by 2030.
Major construction company Icon, which builds offices, apartments and hospitals across Australia, are devoting a percentage of their massive procurement budget to supporting social enterprises. Nicole Donison helps decide how the company spends its money.
It's really motivating for our team. We are able to provide a hand up to people in the community who need it the most simply by thinking differently about the decisions we make day to day, where we spend our dollar and how we can make that dollar go further into the community.
While the vests may cost more compared to major suppliers, Ms. Donison says they offer broader benefits.
We're really focused on quality, reliability, capability and cost. That is the difference. And that's what's important to us, is the value that they deliver. We don't see that as a cost, we see that as an investment.
The spread of the concept is giving business a new way to make profit with a purpose. Here's Edwina Walsh from Assembled Threads.
You actually are moving someone from welfare into a purposeful job where they're getting paid, they're getting respected for their skills, they're contributing to society.
Businesswoman Edwina Walsh ending that report by Ashmita Thiruselvam. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As Donald Trump works to get back to the White House, abortion's become one of his most problematic issues, with some voters turned off by his pro-life stance. So he's changing his language. It's not what anti-abortion activists wanted, but could it win over some key voters? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.